And if I were to ask you, who are the most important people in this design organization? Most folks would say, well, the leaders, the vice president of design, the design directors, this creative director, this director of research. And these folks definitely have impact. But I would argue that the most important people in the organization are the team leads. This is the role around a design team, right? If you've got a team of five or six designers working together, the person leading that team.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lukáš Pitr, and I am one of co-founders of TooFresh. TooFresh has been around for about 16 years, and we have been serving diverse design services from consulting, UX, and communication. In recent year, we decided to change and focus solely on product design. So our purpose changed. Our purpose is to help product teams with design on one side, and on the other, help designers to grow and have diverse jobs. You can check our website for more information. So why TooFresh and why Pitr? In the recent year, we decided to redesign our organization, and it was not so hard to stumble upon Pitr's book, Org Design for Design Orgs. And when I noticed on Twitter that Pitr will be visiting Prague, it was nothing to think about. I reached him and he said yes. And I was so excited to meet him in person, to shake his hand, to thank him. But unfortunately, this morning, Pitr took a COVID test and it went positive. So right now, Pitr is not so far from here.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pitr. I wish I could be with you all. I'm bummed that the pandemic is real, COVID is real, and it's kept me stuck in this hotel room for a few days. I've been able to take walks. I actually feel fine, but that's not what we're here to talk about. What we're here to talk about is how design at scale is people. You see some contact information for me there on this slide. At PitrMe is my Twitter handle. I'm very active on Twitter. Pitr Merholtz is how you can find me on LinkedIn, where I'm pretty active. And then my professional website, PitrMerholtz.com, where I write about design, design leadership, design organizations, those kinds of things, if you want to get my latest thinking. So design at scale is, for my money, the most interesting challenge that we as designers have right now. You know, if you were to ask a bunch of designers, what's the vanguard of design? What should we be looking at? What should we be thinking about in terms of the what's coming? I think a lot of folks would say the metaverse or crypto or Web3 or something that feels somewhat fashionable. But for me, I think what's most important and impactful is just how we are scaling design. We are growing design organizations. We are growing the impact of design. And we're still figuring out how to do that well. And solving that challenge, I think, will have way more impact than applying design to one of these other media. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So if you were to do a Google search for the phrase design at scale, the links that you'll get back will probably focus on design systems. You see some articles here that connect designing at scale with design systems. Sometimes you'll also see conversations around process, right? So I did a Google image search for double diamond, our favorite design process model. Kind of, it's meant to be a bit of a joke here, but it's just meant to reflect on, like, you've got design systems and you have process. And those are the two things that usually are focused on when thinking about design at scale. And that's because there are these two driving considerations when thinking about scaling design. The first is, how do we maintain quality as we grow? We know that it's pretty straightforward to maintain quality when there's 6, 7, 8 designers. You can do it fairly informally. But when you have a design team of 20, 50, 100, 1,000, how do you make sure that quality is consistent as that team scales? And then the other challenge that happens with growth that both design systems and processes are meant to address is that of speed. As an organization grows, as things scale, they tend to get slower because there's more communication and coordination that needs to happen. And so there's a hope that with design systems and design processes, you don't get slowed down as you scale. But I would argue that design, as a practice, operates in a much broader context that usually is not taken into account when thinking about design at scale. And at the heart of that context is the reality that everything is or is becoming a service. I have some images here of products that you used to buy and that are now services that you subscribe to, whether they're cars, services like Lyft or Uber for car sharing. I have an elliptical trainer at home, and when I need to buy a new one, it's going to be hard to find one that's simply a simple exercise machine because of services like Peloton that want me to subscribe to classes and have this ongoing relationship. I no longer buy DVDs because I subscribe to all these streaming services like the Criterion Channel. Airbnb has turned rooms into services. And then I believe Lucas mentioned I'm the author, co-author of a book called Org Design for Design Org. It's published by O'Reilly. If you go to O'Reilly.com, you wouldn't know they publish books. There's no mention of books on their homepage. Instead, they talk about themselves as a learning platform because they're now a service. Because that's, there's many reasons for this. Happy to talk about in Q&A, but the point is everything is becoming a service. And when everything becomes in a service, we need to recognize that the stuff that we build, the products that we're creating, the features that we're creating, they are simply a manifestation of a much broader service relationship. I have here an experience map. This is about a 15-year-old diagram. It's work that Adaptive Path did with Rail Europe, which is actually a service I've used to travel here this trip. And it's a service that, it's a one-stop shop. You go to Rail Europe and then they handle all of the details with all the different rail lines across countries. And the point isn't that. The point is there's a lot that goes on in a service relationship. It's not just about a person at a computer or a person on a phone. They're talking to their friends. They're calling support. They're and when you're traveling, you might be in a train station and not know where to go. There's a lot of touch points and texts that need to be understood when you are enabling a service relationship. And we as designers need to think about that broader context, not just the screen that we happen to be working on at the time. And the reason is, with a service, what customers have to take away is their experience, right? They don't have a thing anymore necessarily, right? But they have the experience that that thing has given them. And in this experience map, we talk about thinking and feeling, and that's really what we're leaving people with when we're designing these services. How do people, in this case, when it comes to travel, are they feeling curious? Are they frustrated? Are they nervous because of the travel anxiety? Are they happy because they're excited to go someplace? Are they stressed that they might not be able to make their connection? After the trip, are they happy to share their photos, right? That's what we're designing for, not just some arbitrary thing, but the feelings and the attitudes that it provides folks. And so Oh, as this service grows, right, as it goes from something simple to getting more and more complex, the chance for fissures, breakpoints, disruptions at different aspects of the service also grows along that end-to-end experience. The bigger and more complicated something is, the more likely it will be breaking down at various points. And so, if we're thinking about design at scale, we can't simply think about quality and velocity. There's a third objective we need to keep in mind, which might be as, if not more important, and that's coherence. How do we maintain this end-to-end experience and make sure that someone moving through it feels like they are being taken care of throughout and not just kind of being left on their own to figure it out? So, I'm going to read this slide. Mechanistic modes of product service delivery have tapped out. It's really hard to get more efficiency from what we're doing, right? We've kind of hit an efficiency wall. Design is valuable because it reintroduces humanism, this understanding of people, this concern for people and how they think and how they feel, into a corporate, business, and technological context that had forgotten people, right? A lot of businesses, particularly when they're thinking about building software, websites, and mobile apps, you tend to focus on technology or you tend to focus on the business and you forget the people. And design is powerful because it reintroduces people as a factor to consider. At one of the later presentations that Steve Jobs gave, he reflected on why he felt Apple was so successful. And he talked about how Apple operated at the intersection of technology and liberal arts, right? I think Steve Jobs would say that a lot of his competitors focus on the technology. They just try to build stuff that's cool, technology for technology's sake. Jobs recognized there was value in liberal arts, humanities, the stuff that breathes life into the things that we build. And that is why Apple is distinctly successful. And in a much earlier quote from his career that I'm pulling now forward, he defined design as the fundamental soul of a man-made creation that ends up expressing itself in successive outer layers of the product or service. Right? If you think of something like Jesse James Garrett's user experience, design operates at each of those levels. We tend to think of design only at the top level, but it really operates at each of those levels. Design is the fundamental soul of a man-made creation. It begs the question, when you're talking about design at scale, how do you scale soul? What does that even mean? Well, you don't scale soul through systems and processes. Systems and processes can be useful, but they may raise the floor for quality and speed, but on their own, they don't have soul. And they risk becoming a focus in and of themselves and actually inhibiting innovation. And I think we see this with design teams that start with design systems or over-focus on process, and they lose sight of actually what it is they're trying to build. Jeremy Keith, who is a consultant at Clear Left, an active web standards advocate and design systems advocate, had a more recent reflection about design systems, and I'll read his quote here. Design systems take their place in a long history of dehumanizing approaches to manufacturing, like Taylorism. The priorities of scientific management are the same as those of design systems, increasing efficiency and enforcing consistency. Dehumanizing is exactly the opposite of what we want design to do, right? Design is meant to bring in humanism. But when we start by focusing on systems and processes, we're now removing from design that which actually makes it interesting and powerful. And so, what I would argue is, before you get into the systems and processes, you need to think about people and culture. That's the foundation. To maintain its soul, design at scale must rest on a foundation of culture and people. So I'm going to talk about culture for a little bit. I'm going to talk about how do you build culture in a design team, and how do you build culture within your company. So as a design team grows from 5 or 6 to start with to 40 or so here, you cannot manage culture informally. The conversations that you might have had around a conference room table or on a simple Zoom call with 5, 6, 7 people, that doesn't work anymore as you grow. You need to start making explicit your culture, what you stand for. And so something that I strongly advocate, and I've worked with a number of design teams in helping them build, is to define their own culture with a charter. Charter is a document that defines what the design team stands for, what it's about. Most design organizations, their identity has typically been defined by non-designers. I should preface what I'm saying because I know we're being hosted by Too Fresh, who is a design agency, and I know there might be some other design agency folks in the audience. What I'm talking about is primarily about in-house design teams, where there's going to be product managers and engineers and marketing and sales and all these other functions. And in those types of environments, design was initially defined usually by a non-designer, unless if the CEO happened to be a designer or the head of product happened to have a design background. You know, they might recognize the need for design, but they're not designers. And so they're like, yeah, we need some designers. Let's hire a head of design and have them hire some designers. But they're thinking of design in a very narrow way. They don't understand all that design can offer. And what I've seen happen over and over again is that a design team, as design organizations grow, as they scale, usually around when they hit 15 to 20 people within the design team, they realize they need to take the reins of their own identity. They need to define themselves. And there's 4 components that I'll be talking about here. And towards the bottom, you'll see a blog post, a link to a blog post that not only goes into more detail, it in turn has links to a Miro board with canvases you can use to create your own charter. The 4 elements of the charter that I'm going to talk about is the purpose. Why does the design team exist? What is its mission? Its values. What does the design team uphold, particularly in the face of challenges, particularly when times are tough? Norms. How does the design team behave, both with itself and then with others? And then success. How does the team know it's doing the right thing? So I'm going to give some examples of each of these elements that I've developed working with real-life design organizations, just so you have a sense of what I mean by making explicit your design culture. And the first is purpose. Every design organization needs to ask itself why it exists. And it shouldn't be, the answer is hopefully not to create assets to give to engineering to code. But instead, some higher order purpose that really taps into the opportunity that design provides. So I'll share 2 purpose statements from 2 different teams that I supported. On the left, or this first one, is for a fairly technical software company working in networking software, networking configuration and setup, I should say. The product design team champions human values throughout strategy and development and empowers users by taming technical complexity and designing reliable, safe, and approachable experiences. And what was important to this team, because they were operating in such a highly technical environment, was to kind of set themselves both apart from that by saying phrases like champions human values, because the engineering driven culture that was dominant in the organization was not recognizing that. Throughout strategy and development was making it clear that they were advocating being included throughout the product development process, not just being brought in at the end once the requirements had been decided, but informing those requirements. And then empowering users by taming that technical complexity, right? That was what they were ultimately delivering. A different organization I supported, a journalism function, a news service in the United States, where we landed was the product design team champions all readers through crafting engaging, excuse me, engaging, enriching, and enduring experiences. And I put it in the shield because I liked that with the word champions, like they were protecting the readers that you see at the top. But they also saw themselves sitting at this intersection of readers, creators, who would be the writers and the photographers and the people producing the journalism, and then the business, who was responsible for sustaining the journalism through advertising or subscriptions. Right? And they saw themselves as sitting at that intersection, but really being the reader's advocate. So it's crucial that you define your purpose. What is it you stand for? And again, make it a high order purpose, something with real meaning. Once you have your purpose statement, you can then figure out kind of one level in, what are the values that your team upholds? So for that technical company that I was talking about earlier, these were the four that we landed on. We went through a whiteboarding exercise where we came up with dozens of terms that could be seen as the values for the team. We grouped them, we removed some, we filtered it down, and this is where we landed, were these four. Curiosity, approachability, Kaizen. So Kaizen is a word that comes from the Toyota lean manufacturing process. So it's a Japanese word, and it basically means continuous improvement, that you're always trying to get better, that you're always learning, you're reflective, and you're getting better. And then empathetic. So these were the four values that they upheld. These were the things that defined how they thought about their work, that they how they would show up and interact with their colleagues, kind of the things that they would either be concerned with, demonstrate, champion, were these qualities. Now, those values are realized through a set of norms, and sometimes it can be confusing, the difference between values and norms. Values are what we believe, norms are how we behave. The first two norms I'm going to show are what are emerging as kind of industry standard norms that many teams, not just even design teams, are starting to embrace. And I'm going to share these just so you have a sense of what I mean by norms. One is psychological safety. There's these five essentially team norms that you're seeing on the left here: psychological safety, dependability, structure and clarity, meaning and impact. Those five came from research that Google did on what made the most successful teams at Google. And their hypothesis was the most successful teams were the teams that had the best people on it. And it turned out that the quality of talent was not even a top five factor in terms of success for a design team. But the single most important, far and away the single most important factor and norm that a successful team demonstrated was psychological safety. And since then, this phrase has gotten quite popular. So you may have heard of it. But basically, it's that idea that any team member can be their full selves. They can push back on kind of the rest of the team without fear that they will be punished. They can tell the leader of the team that they're thinking about things differently, and the leader won't castigate them, won't shame them in some ways. You can make mistakes, and that's okay, as long as we're learning and growing from them. That's what psychological safety is. So that's one emerging norm. The other one that I hear a lot and came up when I was working with design teams was this concept of radical candor. There's this 2x2 that comes from this, originally it was an essay and now a book by Kim Scott called Radical Candor. And that radical candor is a norm, right? It's a willingness to be forthright and direct with our peers. Too often as designers, we tend to be in the upper left-hand corner, what's called ruinous empathy. That's where we're not willing to be truly critical of people in their work because we don't want to make them feel bad. But by not making them feel bad, we're not actually helping them get better, and we're not helping the work be better. And so while people might feel fine in the moment because we haven't hurt their feelings, their development suffers and the work suffers. And so I see a lot of design teams trying to figure out how to move towards radical candor. But then with these teams, and I've, again, done this with a number of teams, you end up developing your own norms. And some of these you'll see are related to what I built. So there was a brand design team that I worked with. And these were the, when we developed the norms, we realized there was a, we put them on the scale because there was a balance. We realized it wasn't all or all one thing or another, but trying to kind of find the right balance between things like practice with empathy, kindness, and even love, but also candor, right? So that's recognizing the value of really not just respecting one another, but being kind and even loving one another, but that in order to do great work, we need to be candid and we need to get to resolution in the moment. We can't put things off. To be honest, direct, and respectful in critique, and then to recognize it's not about you, it's about the work, right? So these are these balances that we struck. So you need to identify your norms. How are you going to behave? How are you going to show up and work with one another? And then lastly, in the charter, it's identifying how you know you're successful. Too often design teams don't have any idea how to measure their own success. And so you need to be very thoughtful and explicit about how you measure your own success. So this goes back to that highly technical software company, the networking company I worked for. On the left-hand side, you'll see four types of success that we identified: team health, organizational integration and influence, delivering quality experiences, and design system adoption. And those were the standards. Those were the ones that we felt would always be around. Team health means things like morale, people not quitting, people sticking around, that kind of thing. Organizational integration and influence was getting to be seen as true partners and collaborators, not as people that you gave requirements to and expected them to just build stuff. So that was how we knew we were going to be successful, and we tried to put some like real numbers behind it. On the right-hand side, there was this kind of this idea that every year we might have a theme for a special OKR. And in this one, the issue that this team was facing was that designers tended to work on their own. They were spread a little too thin, and so they tended to work one designer working with the product manager in engineering as opposed to designers collaborating. And so we said as a something to aim for was that by the end of the following year, designers would collaborate on at least half of their work. Right? That's measurable. You should be able to look at all the projects that designers are working on and see if that's happening. And so the reason to write this down is so that you hold yourself accountable for what you say you want to be. And the sum of all of these elements is your culture, right? This is how you make your culture explicit. So when I talk about making culture explicit in the design org, this is what I'm talking about. So that's one place you need to make culture explicit. The other place you need to make culture explicit is scaling a company wide. So how do you make sure that your design culture is, how do you make sure that your company is embracing design appropriate? One, a key indicator that design is being considered appropriately company wide is that you have a single head of design. I'm working with a company in Germany right now, whose VP of design has left, and there's two directors of design, and they're not replacing that VP of design. And that is a big red flag that design is not being respected, because the function of design, the care and feeding of those designers, the consideration for how we do design work, is not being given a single leader to really own and drive forward. And so when you have two leaders, two heads of design, really, the head of design at that point is their boss, who's often not a designer. So you need to have a head of design who leads that function. That head of design should be no more than two levels from the CEO, or in a truly large organization, kind of a local general manager, line of business lead. If the head of design is any lower, they don't have access to the leadership that they need in order to do their work, right? So if you think about that experience map, in order to deliver a great end-to-end experience, you need to inform marketing, you need to inform product, you need to inform sales, you need to inform customer service, right? Design has to be able to work with all those teams. And if this design head of design was one level lower, their boss's peers wouldn't be those functions. Here, this head of design, reporting to this SVP of product, that person's peers are going to be the head of marketing and the head of engineering and the head of sales. And so that head of design now has a way into those conversations. If they're any lower, they wouldn't. And that prevents your design team from having the impact it could have. Design, in order for design to see the kind of impact company-wide that you want it to have and to be treated seriously within its culture, you need to have executive commitment and investment. This is an image of Ginni Rometty. She was the CEO of IBM when they launched IBM Design in 2012. And she pledged something on the order of like $100 million to invest in design for that first 5 years and to scale the design team to 2,000 and to bring in Phil Gilbert to lead that team. And Phil Gilbert was two levels from her. So she was the CEO. Phil Gilbert was two levels, though he had a dotted line relationship with her. And my point here is partly you need that kind of executive commitment in order for design to really be seen as across a company as a true kind of important function. But another point of mine is IBM is like a 150-year-old company. Like that with 400,000 employees or 300,000 employees, it's huge, it's old. It's kind of the very definition of kind of old technology. And if they can embrace design at this level, there's no reason that any newer company can't also do that as well. The last thing I wanted to talk about in terms of scaling design culture company-wide, right? So you need singular design leadership. You need to make sure that you're getting that kind of executive engagement. But then there's tools that can spread design practice throughout the company. And whether you call it HCD for human-centered design or design thinking, teaching non-designers basics of design matters. A lot of designers get nervous about this idea of design thinking or teaching non-designers design practices. But from what I've seen over and over and over again, it is one of the most successful levers for getting an entire company to appreciate the value of design and to actually embrace professional designers even more. When I gave this talk at the Rosenfeld Media Design at Scale conference, and the woman who spoke after me was from ExxonMobil, right? Massive gas, petroleum company. And she had spearheaded this type of work, design thinking across the company. And they had results that just showed just how much this type of training and access to this type of thinking had helped generally level up ExxonMobil's appreciation and awareness for design throughout the organization. So that's culture. I'm now going to spend a little bit of time talking about people. And I'm going to focus on particularly one role that enables scale. There's a lot I could talk about here, but for time, I'm only talking about one role that enables scale. And when you look at a design organization like this, 40-some people, and if I were to ask you, who are the most important people in this design organization? Most folks would say, well, the leaders. The vice president of design, the design directors, this creative director, this director of research. And these folks definitely have impact. But I would argue that the most important people in the organization are the team leads. This is the role around a design team, right? If you've got a team of five or six designers working together, the person leading that team might be a manager, might not be a manager, and this is something we can talk about. Whether this is like more of a principal designer who's not a manager or a design manager. But that team lead, leading the work of these five or six people, they're the most important role in the organization. Why? Well, on one hand, it's the relationships that revolve around them. That team lead needs to manage down, needs to manage that team of five or six designers and get the most out of them. I have a separate design leadership talk and I use archetypes to define them, and this archetype I call a coach, right? And the role of the coach, when a team lead is embracing that archetype, their job is to create, to get the most out of their team. to provide a vision for success. Where are we going? To really understand the people on the team as individuals, not just as resources. And perhaps most importantly, to uphold standards of quality, right? It's at this level, the reason this role is so important is because the people that the team lead is leading are the ones doing the design work. And through that doing of the design work, they're the ones who are determining the quality of the design, ultimately. So the team lead is the one who makes sure that design is upholding the standards of quality that the organization has agreed to. But it's not just managing down. These team leads also have to manage across, right? They have to be a diplomat. They have to work well with product managers, engineers, potentially product marketing people, sales people, and help them understand what it takes for design to succeed and what design needs in order to succeed. And there's a lot that goes into it. What I'm going to focus on here is another balance to strike, which is, as a diplomat, these team leads need to make it clear to, say, the product management leaders and the engineering leaders that we're in this together. My goals are your goals. We have shared needs. And so it's important for these team leads to avoid victim stances. Very often, design leaders feel like product people, product managers, don't give them enough latitude to do what they want. We don't have enough time. We can't do research, all this type of stuff. You can't be a victim as a leader. You need to avoid that stance. You need to engage with those product folks and make sure you understand why they're saying those things and then work with them together to get what you want. And you need to recognize everyone is doing their best, right? That product person who's giving you these weird deadlines probably has a lot of pressures coming in on them. But while you're being a good team player, that doesn't mean that you're a pushover, right? Diplomats always want to get something. They're not just giving things up, they're getting things. And so you need to stand strong for your ideals. And that's why it's so important to define your culture. All that charter work that I was talking about, those are your ideals as a team lead that you're standing for, standing strong for. And you need to make sure that you're representing those values and those norms in this conversation that you're having with your cross-functional peers. And then the last relationship that's really important for the team lead is to manage up executives and other stakeholders. Because they'll often, you're going to get a lot coming at your team from these executives. And one of the roles of the team lead is to be what's sometimes called the shit umbrella. And to protect the team from all this chaos that can come from above. And to handle those conversations directly with CEOs or senior vice presidents or whomever, and not let your team get spun up by them. And then to help those leaders understand the great work that your team is doing. So that's one reason why the team lead is this crucial role, right? All this stuff pivots around them. And so that becomes the super important role. And they're the ones in the trenches that make sure that design culture that we defined is actually living and breathing. Design directors, VPs, can model culture, can define culture, but they're not the ones really driving and living that culture. It's the team leads and the people that they're leading. But the other important reason that the team lead role is so important is goes back to what I was talking about at the very beginning around that end-to-end experience, because they can help provide coherence. So let's say you have an e-commerce experience. And you need to go, and so you're providing some type of online shopping experience or online offline shopping experience. And you might have a bunch of different product teams doing different aspects of it, growth and search and browse and reviews and checkout and shopping cart. Now, if we remember, we don't want folks to just like engage with these different features willy-nilly. As we said earlier, features are manifestations of this broader relationship. And so we need to orchestrate, right? There's this orchestra. We need to orchestrate that experience. And so that's another role that team leads have, is if I'm a buyer going through the shopping experience, I don't want to be thinking about product teams. I want to be thinking about my shopping journey. And so design organizations should be organized by that journey, right? So you might have one team that's around discovery. researching products and figuring out which one is the best one. Another design team that's around purchase. Once you've decided to buy one, putting it in your cart, checking out, maybe if there's things, make a reservation, right? If there's timing that needs to be done around it, scheduling pickup and delivery, that kind of stuff. And then post-purchase, right? There's reviews and service and maybe sharing experiences or other things that could happen, right? So it's a great idea to organize your design team by journey instead of organizing them in these little product buckets. But then you need to hang those three teams together, and you'll see the team leads are lit up there, because the team leads are what connect, are what make sure that end-to-end experience hangs together. The team leads manage down to make sure their team is doing good work, and then they work with each other to make sure that each of their teams is building something that will cohere. I would argue that it's these team leads, these people, not systems, are what provide the soul of design at scale. When I first asked, how do you scale soul? You scale it through the work of individual people collaborating to make sure this thing hangs together as it grows. So, people and culture. This humanist foundation provides the soul. Something I haven't even touched on. Vision, right? Kind of where is it we're heading? That aligns distributed effort. What do I mean by that? You got 20, 40, 100 designers. They need something that keeps them all kind of oriented on that North Star. That's why it's a star, right? On that same goal. And that's the vision. And that vision will make sure that the work of all those 100 people is moving toward a common outcome. Once you have the people and culture and the vision, then you can layer in the processes and systems. Because those elements will ensure that the systems are serving people and not just serving themselves. And with that, I thank you. That's the end of my talk. So if any of you come to Oakland, California, I will buy you a beer. That seems to be the Czech thing to do.
Yes, that's what we do here. Thank you very much, Peter. We got some questions here. Okay, I will start with my personal question. You teach designers to lead, right?
I try.
I am wondering, how do you do that?
Oh. Well, now the way I do it, practically through workshops. I have a master class on design leadership, and in that master class, what I end up focusing on, I can actually show you if I can. I basically teach. I dig into these what I call archetypes: coach, diplomat, champion. And then I also have one called the architect. We talk about what it means to be a design leader, which is different than being a design practitioner, right? One of the biggest challenges that people have when they shift from being a designer to a design leader is all of your practitioner skills don't really matter anymore, except to the degree that they help you, like, maybe do better critique. And you need to develop a whole new set of skills, which is largely around this word, relationships. Because design leadership is mostly about talking. It's about talking to your team and getting the most out of them. It's about talking to your peers and helping them understand what your team needs in order to succeed. And it's about talking to your bosses, either to let them understand how great your team is, or to push back on their unreasonable requests. It's a lot of talking. And not a lot of designers, right, are trained, equipped, good at having those kinds of conversations. And so that becomes essentially the focus of my design leadership teaching.
You spoke about the importance of design in the strategy of an organization, but many of them are not set for this. How do you make them recognize design as something strategic?
Okay. So you need to, this is where that relationships and the communication is so important. In order to help others understand the strategic potential of design, you need to communicate that. You need to educate them about it. You need to evangelize. And so you need to talk to those leaders and help them understand how design can have an impact on the things they care about. And that means often not talking in design language, but instead talking in business language. I don't know if this will be a fair analogy, but since I'm talking to people who speak Czech, I did some research today. There's about 10 million people who speak Czech, the Czech language in the world. There's probably 2 billion, maybe at least 1 billion who speak English. So understandably, a lot of Czech people have learned English so that they can communicate globally. Being a designer who only talks design is kind of like being someone from Czechia who only speaks Czech. And if you're trying to persuade people in other countries about what it is you're doing and you only speak Czech to them, they're not going to understand and they're not going to listen to you. So you learn, oh, I have to learn another language in order to have that kind of impact. The same is true for designers. Designers need to learn how to talk the language of business and whatever your business cares about, because that's the majority language in our work is the language of business. So you need to start talking about acquisition and retention and satisfaction and whatever it is that your specific company cares about. It might be NPS scores, might be unit economics, it might be monthly active users, whatever those outcomes that your company is interested in, that's the language you need to be speaking in. And then you connect your design team's strategic work with those outcomes.
Okay, hello Peter.
Hello.
My question would be, like, how early is too early to start designing the design org? What would be different approaches you would take at different levels of maturity and scale of the organization?
So in the design organization book, we start designing the organization when there's two people. One of the tenets of the book is there should never be a single designer. And so when you start a design organization, there should be at least two designers. Just because design is so complex, the work we're doing is so complex that no one person can do it all well enough. And so you need to be, even if it's just two designers, you need to start thinking about that very intentionally. Who are these two designers? Do you have one more senior, one more junior? Do you have one more who's really good at the structural stuff, the workflows and the flow diagrams and that stuff, and someone who's better at UI and visual design, right? Like, these are conscious decisions, even at only two people. So I would say you need to start having some reflection early on. It really kicks into gear when you get to about 10 to 12 people. That's in the book, we call that stage three. And that's when you have a design organization that's now more than one team. When you're seven people, you're one team, you can be pretty informal. But when you're 10 people, 12 people, you now have multiple design teams, because you should never have a team greater than seven, right? So if you have 12 people in your design organization, you should have two teams, maybe one team of five, one team of six, and then someone leading those teams. So now that requires thinking organizationally. How do you define each team? Who's on those teams? What are their relationships? What are the relationships to you? Right. So when you hit that 10 to 12 person threshold, you're starting to think much more explicitly about design. And that's often what I've seen when that first design leader, right? So a company hires a design leader to establish a team. That person builds the team, six, seven people. Once it starts getting larger than that, that first designer often realizes, like, oh, my job is just management now and talking to other people. Like, I don't do design anymore. When you have a design team of 10, the leader of that team is not doing design anymore. Shouldn't be, at least. And a lot of design leaders, a lot of those first designers realize, like, that's not the job they want. They love design. That's why they got into it. And so I see over and over again, that's when companies bring on someone who is comfortable being that org builder. So about 12 is the first one. Then probably again, well, when you're around 15 or 20, that's when you start bringing in design operations with design program management. That's a key step. And then as you continue to grow, particularly if you're in hypergrowth, like if you know you're going to get to 40, let's say you're at 20. I supported a team last year that was going from 15 designers to 40 in 9 months. So they needed to be very conscientious about how they were growing that organization. They needed to have an org chart for what it would look like at 40. To when to hire design leaders and other designers, like how to fill it out. So they weren't just like hiring for the sake of hiring, but there was a plan behind it. And then one of the roles you need then, when you're growing that fast, if you're trying to hire 20 designers in a year, you start needing not just design program management, but you start needing design operations specific to what would be called people operations for design. Levels frameworks, career ladders, growth paths, recruiting practices, onboarding, all that kind of stuff becomes important. Then when you get to 80 or 100, that becomes a new level of complexity. And then when you get kind of north of about 300, there's another level of complexity. I can go into that in more detail, but I don't know how relevant that is.
Great. Thank you, Peter. Next question is from Gabriela.
So my question is how to define and name team culture in practice for different sizes or maturity levels, and whether it should be defined by the single leader or a group of leaders or team leads, or should it be created collaboratively somehow?
Yeah, so when I've done this work, most of the teams I support usually realize they need this type of explicit team culture, somewhere between 15 to 20 designers. And at that size, pretty much the whole design team can be involved in the creation of that charter. I've led workshops with 15 designers, figuring out our purpose statement, figuring out our value statement, figuring out our norms, all that kind of stuff. If the team is already bigger than that and realizes they haven't done this work and needs to do it, then you need to have some subset. I would say you don't want any more than 15 people involved. It just gets to be kind of chaotic trying to define culture. And in those cases, the people who should be involved, you definitely want the leadership involved, right? So the VP of design and design directors and that kind of stuff. But then you also want people who can kind of represent every kind of experience level in the organization. Right, so you might have one or two junior designers, one or two mid-level designers, one or two senior designers with that leadership all working together to define the culture. And it's important that you have those people who represent the more junior people on the team so that the charter feels like something that everyone in the organization can own and isn't something that simply the leadership has pushed down on the rest of the organization.
Thank you.
Hi, Peter. Could you please elaborate more on UX research specifically? If you prefer embedded researcher on team or consultancy approach when talking about UX research, and your thoughts why? Thanks.
Yeah, research. That's a big topic. Let's see if I can pull up that slide. It'll take too long. So UX research is crucial. It's so important that it shouldn't only be researchers doing research. So I'm an advocate of everyone in the design org taking part in research. Because of that, I don't need as many dedicated researchers. Right. And so in the book, and I still generally subscribe to this ratio, roughly one UX researcher for every 8 to 10 designers. But again, that's assuming those designers are doing research. And in that mode, those researchers usually have two roles. Part of their role is to help designers and product managers and others doing research, help them do better research, help them think about what are the methods that they're going to use to learn new information and to figure something out. And so there's a kind of a mentorship and elevation function. And then the second role that that researcher has is to do deep research on hard, hairy research problems that would take longer than we would be able to let a designer do research, right? So, you know, you need to do a diary study for 2 weeks of some, of 20 people. You're not going to pull a designer off of their work and into some study usually to be able to devote them to that. So that's where you want dedicated UX researchers who can go really deep. So to answer in the language of your question, I tend towards a somewhat more consultative relationship between research and the rest of the team most of the time. Now, I think there can be exceptions, particularly in domains that are highly specialized. So if you're working in healthcare and you're working with doctors and nurses and in hospitals and clinics, that's a highly specialized domain. There you want research embedded on the team because you're going to need more research muscle doing that work. But if you're working on e-commerce, right? So I've typically done a lot of work in e-commerce. That's not as specialized, right? We've all bought stuff online. So you need research and you want some dedicated researchers to help you think through it, but you don't need that level of depth being brought to bear that you would if you were researching, again, healthcare or certain kinds of financial services or certain just specialty fields, you know, HR professionals or something like that.
Hello, Peter. My question Hello. Is about if you have any of your own favorite less conventional methods, how to make the culture heard in the organization, and how to make sure that the people are like familiar with it. Because I see, like with larger teams, that very often it's being forgotten because the people are focusing just on the design work every day. So something like I was thinking maybe like starting every internal team meeting with some telling some story that shows the culture or something or some similar method, something favorite of your own things.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I'm not particularly, I don't have a good answer to that. So apologies. One thing I have done that I used to share, and I think Lucas, when you saw my old talk, I talked about it. I've since removed it. Is this idea of what I call artifacts that carry culture, right? So let's say you've defined your purpose statement, your values, your norms. When I've led design teams internally, we put our values on a t-shirt and we wore them. And we each value got its own postcard. And we created these sets of cards. And every designer, we had this little lunchbox, a little metal box, and we put t-shirts and cards and other things in that box, and we gave them to each designer so that they felt like they were really a part of something now. That they weren't just a designer anymore, but they were part of a design organization that had its own identity, had its own culture, had its own mindset, and it kind of was demonstrated through these cards and t-shirts and stickers and other things that made you feel like you were part of something. So that's one way I've done it. You know, what you said I like introducing, excuse me, it's one of the importance of norms, right? Those behaviors is being able to introduce rituals like you described. But I'm not particularly clever in that regard. So I'm sure the people in this room in 10 minutes could think up better ideas than I could off the top of my head right now. But excellent question.
Thanks.
Tomáš Jágr, right here.
Hello. You suggested Hello. To establish the role of vice president for design as a function, as a functional lead. So my question is, what are the pros and cons of like distributing the design expertise across like segment or service or product centric tribes, you know, when talking about like companies turning towards agile product development?
Yeah. How long we got? It's a big one. The primary one is design needs to be defined within a company in a somewhat singular fashion in order to, because at least I believe that design's greatest role is not supporting agile development. I don't care about agile development. Agile development is a means to an end. Design's greatest role is delivering a powerful end-to-end experience for your customer. And that experience starts with some type of marketing touch, an ad, some bit of marketing that someone's exposed to that gets them curious about what you have to offer, that gets them into your world, gets them learning about it, that gets them committed to what you have to offer, that gets them turning into a customer, that then puts them on their journey now as a customer of what you have to offer. And then if there's problems that arise or ongoing things, right, there's service and support or other functions as well. There's a lot there. But all of that should be coherent and coordinated. And if you've got multiple design leaders, that coordination is much harder because each of those design leaders usually is then responsive to one pillar in the business, but your customers are going across those pillars. So that's one reason why you want design, a single head of design who's organizing all that. And when I say single head of design, I also mean one person overseeing design for marketing and product. I actually think having separate marketing and product design teams or UX design teams is a bad idea for this reason. Marketing and product are simply two stages of the same service experience. A second reason, though, is defining design and design culture and all the stuff that I've been talking about today. If you have three or four different heads of design reporting up to different parts of the organization, now your company has four different design cultures. And let's say you're trying to recruit designers into your company. And a designer is trying to understand your company. And they're like, why does this design team talk about design differently than that design team? I'm actually dealing with this right now. I'm supporting a very large bank in the United States, 200,000 employees, 1,200 people doing design work across four different organizations. And one of the big issues they have is those organizations don't coordinate. So sometimes it's called UX design, sometimes it's called product design, sometimes it's called UX UI design. Sometimes they have multiple teams competing for the same candidate and they don't know it because they've got their own recruiting functions. So it introduces this by having design broken up, you get this weird within the company, you get a lot of confusion. And then additionally, just because it keeps going, is really clarifying what it means to be a designer in that organization. How do you grow as a designer? If I'm in one part of the company and the way I grow as a designer is different than another part of the company, if one part of the company is like, yes, you can be you can grow as an individual contributor, you can become a principal designer and design architect. But another part of the company is like, no, in order to grow, you have to become a manager. That's confusing, right? We now don't have a standard understanding of what design means in the organization. That I'm thinking about that because that's actually something else I'm dealing with in this large bank that I'm supporting. And so as much as possible, you want all of your designers and researchers and content people, all the people doing this design work, aligned with a common organization and a common sensibility that's driving them forward. If you've got multiple design leaders, you're going to get, it's just going to become chaos. It's going to become madness. It's going to become a lot of people competing with each other internally, which kind of defeats the purpose of being in a company. You might as well be four different companies then.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of the reasons. It's part of the reason I wrote the book.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for the talk. I would like to ask if there's any way or how to be strong team leader or and still have enough time for design and do deep work with your designers instead of managing them.
So yes, is the short answer, right? If you're a team lead, you're overseeing four or five other designers. If you're overseeing four or five other designers, you should have time to do design work. Particularly if you're not a formal manager of those designers, but a principal designer, staff designer, what you know, these more senior individual contributor roles. You know, if you're able to be one of those senior individual contributors leading the work of these four or five other designers, then yes, you should have time to roll up your sleeves and get in there and do the detailed and fun and hard design work. Excuse me. If you're a manager of those four or five people, you can still do it. It's going to take some of your time away from being a manager. Will take some of your time away from design because you're going to have to do one-on-ones. You're going to have to do performance reviews, you know, all that management stuff. But I think it's still possible with four or five designers. It's when you start getting 7, 8, 9 designers in an organization that you're managing that you can no longer do hands-on design work. These are rough numbers, like heuristics, but that's been my experience. And I think I haven't heard questions about this, but just reflecting on what I'm seeing in the United States and other, actually some of the other people I'm working with outside of the United States even, we are starting to see more acceptance of senior designers who are not managers. So if you start as a junior designer, then a mid-level designer, then a senior designer, you could choose which track you go. If you want to be a manager, you can become a manager and a director and a VP. Or you can say, you know what, I want to become a lead designer. I want to become a principal designer. I want to become a design architect. And those are seen as equivalent tracks, right? Manager to lead designer, director to principal designer, VP to design architect. Those are viable paths forward. And I think we're seeing more and more of that because it's being recognized that management takes time. If someone's being a manager, it's hard for them to be a hands-on design leader too, especially as the team grows. And so we need these dedicated design leaders who don't manage to take up some of that slack.
Okay, thank you.
One last question that is trending a lot.
Uh-oh.
And it comes from Marketa.
Hello, just quick question. I like your t-shirt. Yes, very much, so much. So where did you get it?
There's a podcast. It always starts with a podcast. There's a podcast called Judge John Hodgman. It's on the Maximum Fun Network. I've been listening to it for about 10 years. And in this, this comedian, John Hodgman, settles disputes. And they're usually pretty silly. And oftentimes, there are disputes between fathers and their children about some rule or policy or thing that the father is trying to have the child take part in. And so it happened so much that it became this pattern that they called Weird Dads. And so they made a t-shirt called Weird Dads. And then I forget if it was, Jules, was this for my birthday or Father's Day that you guys got me the Weird Dad t-shirt? My son is on the other side of this laptop. I didn't buy it myself, but for a present, my family bought me this t-shirt. So, and since yesterday was Father's Day in the United States, and I forgot to wear it yesterday, I decided to wear it today.
Thank you.
Sure.
Peter, yes, you wanted to say something.
I was just going to say, you said this was the last question, so again, I'm super bummed. I can't be with you all in person. Hold me to account if any of you are in Oakland or Berkeley. I won't necessarily agree to go to San Francisco. Kind of a pain to get across the bay. But if you're in Oakland or Berkeley, in the East Bay, in the Bay Area, I will buy you a beer. Happy to have a conversation. And Lucas, thank you so much for your hospitality. This it wasn't how we wanted to have it, but it, I think, has turned out pretty well. I hope all of you as in attendance got something out of my talk and now get something out of getting to hang out with one another. I would caution you, if you do, you know, wear a mask. I got COVID at an event in Vienna that was like this because I didn't wear a mask. So I hope you're either not with COVID or you all have masks. Be safe, everybody.
Peter, thank you very much.
Take care.
That's it. Let's have fun. Enjoy the drinks, enjoy the food. That's it.